You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, the podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you've been listening to and enjoying our little podcast, please help us out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island to learn more. Again, folks, if you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you and you would like to see it keep going strong, please consider becoming a patron of our show. You can go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island and sign up. Patrons get exclusive access to a live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. I love that chat. You're going to love it, too. Go to patreon.com/diggin' oak island. Sign up. Support the podcast. It's only $5 a month. You can cancel anytime. If you don't want to do the monthly thing, you want to make a one-time donation, I can set that up for you. You could do that by going to Venmo and using the username at Dave McBride Music. It's the best I can come up with. That is my musician's virtual tip jar, so to speak. So if you want to make a one-time donation, you could do it there. Venmo, username at Dave McBride Music. All right. We have some emails and messages to get to, so let's start, actually, with a direct message from Facebook by a listener with the fabulous name of Dave, who writes, "I'm so bummed about the Garden Shaft project. This seems to be the most ambitious and successful endeavor so far on Oak Island. The flooding that they are experiencing changed everything. Even the company guys look totally flummoxed. Simply pumping out the water doesn't fix the problem, and how this will be addressed is disheartening. Can they actually stop the water? Because if they can't, it would seem that the shaft just becomes a big, expensive hole in the ground. Also, the dig on Lot 5 still perplexes me. I really can't see any connection to the money pit, but there must be, right? I mean, oh well, I still enjoy the show, and I look forward to your podcast, Dave." Dave, with regards to the garden shaft, if you go through the history of the island, you know, for the past 230 years, you'll find a storied history of what you called their expensive holes in the ground. Each and every searcher who has dug such a hole, and they have all run into the same exact problem, flooding. Will the Dumas and the Lagina brothers be able to solve this problem? You know, it's hard for me to be confident in that because exactly no one who has ever dug in the money pit over the past 230 years has ever been able to solve that problem, even to the smallest degree, to do anything, right? So I don't have much confidence that anyone actually can. And sure, the Laginas are the best funded and all that kind of stuff, but it's still water. I mean, what are you going to do? As far as Lot 5 is concerned, I don't see a connection to the money pit yet either. But the key word here is yet. Archaeological excavations take time, a lot of time. So we're going to need to be patient with this one. My fear is, though, as the season comes to an end, is that we have seen this before, right? We've seen this picture before with archaeological sites on the island. Whatever happened to Samuel Ball's excavation or so many other sites that we can remember? I'm really concerned we see the work finished this year, and then that's it. We never see it again. You know, fingers crossed that that's not the case because, as I have said, regardless of whether or not we see a connection on Lot 5 directly to the money pit and the treasure, it is still obviously a really interesting, undocumented piece of history of the island that we need to explore in order to get the full picture of what occurred here on Oak Island before we really have good history to go by. All right, let's go now to Maurice, who wrote on the same subject. "Hello, Dave. I saw the scene of water going into the garden shaft, as you told us on the last podcast. They're making a hole in the wall, and there is water flowing in with some pressure. It is possible that it hit an open space filled with water. If it is a tunnel, for example, and is 2 to 3 meters higher filled up with water, then you'll see what they saw with that probe boring water released with pressure. Keep up the good work on the podcast, Maurice." That is certainly an optimistic view of the situation, that perhaps the water is coming from an offset chamber or a tunnel on the other side. I do like that idea. Perhaps it is a situation where the offset chamber itself is actually there and is just completely flooded, causing that pressure into the money pit, but or into the garden shaft. That was a Freudian slip there. But the problem is the water just keeps coming. So there's a source to it, and it's salt. So, you know, I don't know. I it's hard to say. Like you say, they must have hit some sort of water-filled opening of some kind, causing the water to come in at such a pressure. But the thing is, we've heard no discussion at all of what might be on the other side of this wall that they drilled into. That leads me to believe they know it is, in fact, some sort of natural water source or a cave or something like that. Listen, we've had two major projects this season, Lot 5 and the Garden Shaft, and I can absolutely see a reality that next season, neither of these two projects are discussed again. It's happened before. Anyway, I'm not trying to be a pessimist here. Pessimism and realism are often confused on Oak Island. But there you go. Thank you so much, Maurice. Great observations there. Let's go to an email from an old friend of ours. Here's Warren, who writes, I know you are not a fan of the drilling down episodes, but last week was really interesting. And he's referring not to the one we saw this past Tuesday, but the one before that. As they delved deeper into the science of archaeoastronomy. However, what was the biggest eye-opener was that at the very end of the episode, Maddie asked the brothers if, after all of these trips and discoveries, they believe the Templars did something on the island, and they both said no, not without more data. This really took me by surprise, as this is a moment of clarity and the exact opposite of the narrative that we are constantly fed. If only this was promoted more on the show. If this is the feeling of the group, let's hear it, Warren. Warren, you're not exactly correct when you say I'm not a fan of drilling down. I am a fan. I always watch them. The more Oak Island, the better in my mind. It's just that these shows just almost always have nothing more really than a lot of recapping and a lot of talking to the guys about stuff we already know. Just doesn't make a good subject for the podcast. But going back and looking again at the episode, and what you wrote here, yes, you're correct. That was a cool little line there. So let's dive into it. So the show is billed about being about archaeoastronomy. And to a large extent, it was. But what it really was a show about the Templar theory. Like most of these drilling down shows, this one ends with a sort of interview segment with Maddie Blake and Rick and Marty Lagina seated in the woods on bar stools. Maddie asks, how likely is it that let me get the exact quote here for you so you guys have exactly what he says. He writes, quote, how likely is it that it was indeed the Knights Templar that buried treasure on Oak Island? Marty answers, quote, in my opinion, still highly unlikely, but possible. Rick gives a similar answer, if not a bit more evasive, saying things like you can't eliminate it in a growing body of evidence and that kind of stuff. It was certainly not a definitive dismissal of the theory, but also not anything near an endorsement of the theory, right? Listen, the Laginas have to play this game, and they have to play this game pretty carefully, right? They want viewers too, and they understandably lean on the producers of the show for how this is best done, right? That's not their, they don't know television. These guys do. So I get it. But yes, Warren, I do think we get a little insight here into what the brothers really think of the Templar theory, certainly Marty. My guess is if you get him off the record, his answer might be just a little bit different than that, right? But along the similar lines. So let's go now to an email, and this one comes from Ray, entitled Oak Island Through a Margarita Glass. I prefer a good pint of beer to watch my Oak Island through, but or a little crown, however it goes. Anyway, he writes, Dave, just a couple of thoughts about the show. I have been interested in Oak Island since a kid. Growing up in Canada, I've been an avid viewer of the TV series since episode one, season one. I recently found your podcast online. I enjoy the podcast and I'm pleased to hear that there are so many others out there that have the same observations as I have. I now live in Mexico, and I can only stream the episodes a week or so after the U.S. broadcast, so my comments may have already been addressed. My main comments are based around the work in the garden shaft. Why did they have to shut down work in the garden shaft for the winter? I can understand surface work, like that being done in the swamp or on Lot 5, but work in the shaft is clearly a mining operation. They're under the frost line and should have no problem with their attempts to directional drill of offset chambers. I'm not a miner, but I did spend the 80s working on an oil patch in Canada's north. Back then, the technology is nowhere near what it is today. Are you familiar with the oil patch term of fracking? If not, it's basically a process of isolating an area immediately above or below the zone wishing to be produced. Once packed off, high-pressure air is pumped into the zone in order to fracture the zone to allow the product, oil or natural gas, to flow into the wellbore. I wonder if this process could be reversed somewhat to force air into the garden shaft where the recent mystery flooding has occurred to push the flood water back. Perhaps some of the compressed air might bubble up to the surface, indicating the sort of flood tunnels, if in fact there are actually flood tunnels. This last point, I'm just spitballing. As I mentioned above, I'm not a miner. Neither am I a geologist or a metallurgist, but ox shoes, barrel staves, the stone road, and the finding of underground wood clearly suggests that there was some pre-searcher activity on the island. Was this done by pirates, Vikings, or the Knights Templar? Who knows? But what if all these items and constructs are not for the depositing of precious metals, but for the removal of these commodities? Trace elements of gold and silver were found in the Baby Blob. Maybe the series should be renamed The Curse of Ore Island. Granted, this possibility doesn't hold a lot of weight, as if there was any mining conducted, you would think there should be some historical record about it. And why would anyone go to such length to hide such an operation? These are things that you think about when you're awake at 2 a.m. and make you go, thanks for the podcast. Keep them coming, Ray. Ray, I do that a lot, thinking about Oak Island stuff at that hour, going, It's great stuff, man. Yeah, I'm no mining expert either. But anyone else, you know, do you guys know if the work at the garden shaft can be conducted in the winter? I assume the Laginas and Craig Tester leave the island and head back to their, you know, normal lives, I guess you would call it, in Michigan. But much of the team is local now. Could they stay and take part in winter work? I simply don't know. But what you say here makes all the sense in the world. You know, it is possible that the camera crew is what is causing them to stop work. They can't. They don't want to film them, or they can't, which means how much work can they really do if they're not going to film it? What's the point, right? Now, as far as the concept of precious metals being found or mined in Nova Scotia, I mean, yeah, we've talked about this before, but it's always a good topic to revisit because it is never discussed on the show. Yes, folks, absolutely there are gold deposits in Nova Scotia. In fact, Nova Scotia has seen its fair share of what we down here would call gold rushes, right? I mean, they're not as famous as like the Klondike gold rush and the ones in California and things like that, but they were pretty intense. In fact, there were two or three gold rush periods in Nova Scotia, starting from the mid-19th century and extending well into the 20th century. And a lot of these took place pretty close to Oak Island. One gold rush brought thousands of prospectors to what is now called the Gold River. The mouth of this river you can actually see from the north side of Oak Island with a naked eye. So when I say close, I mean rowing distance close. Now, Dr. Spooner and the other scientists who worked on these precious metal tests in the Baby Blob are local scientists in this field. I simply have to assume that they know of these deposits and would also know if what they were looking at or could be something just natural. I mean, we have to assume that's true, that these guys would know what they were looking at is indeed just natural deposits in a very natural way historically throughout this area. It just makes sense. And also, like I said, in the late 19th and 20th century, yes, I would imagine it would be very, very unusual if one of these mining things was conducted there and there's no records of it. But before that, if somebody's mining that, why would they leave records behind, you know? And then storms come through, take down the buildings that they, you know, constructed for this purpose. Who knows? Even if it's, you know, but if it's from the time that we have the mining, you know, the documented history of the mining, then there would be stories from landowners and that kind of thing. Ray, I think that's a long-winded way of me saying that I don't think things like Lot 5 and the Money Pit were built by gold prospectors, but it could possibly answer the question of the source of these test results. But who knows if we'll ever get an answer on that. I mean, we've been talking about these tests now for, what, 2 years, and we don't seem any closer to any answers on what they were than when we first detected them a couple of years ago. All right, let's finish up with an email from our friend Patrick, who writes, "Hi, Dave. We now have at least two buttons from Lot 5 that can be documented to very different time periods. There's the British Royal Artillery button with three cannons that was previously discovered, which dates back to the 1700s. And now we have a post-medieval button with a starburst lead alloy design. Based on Google research, I found a similar button dating between 1200 and 1500 AD that was discovered in the southeast of England. Attached are comparisons of both buttons that were discovered on Lot 5 to similar buttons from those time periods." And I'll post those pictures that Patrick sent for you guys. "I have one nagging question that bothers me every time they discover an older artifact. Does finding an old artifact provide strong evidence that someone occupied the island during that time period? Or was it common for these types of artifacts to be traded or handed down over the many centuries only to be lost at a later date? In other words, I imagine people living in the 1700s and earlier were way better at preserving and reusing things like decorative buttons and holy relics than we are nowadays. A good example would be the old chain they discovered near the edge of the swamp that I believe dated to the 1600s, but it was attached to another chain that dated to more modern times, like the early 1900s. This seems to suggest that people were less wasteful and better about holding on to and reusing older items than we are now. Another question for a future Laird interview. Patrick, another terrific observation. And I tend to think along your lines here. One find, we would call with an outlier date, is simply not enough evidence of an occupation to me. Outliers make for good television, but not great archaeological evidence. And absolutely, people were less wasteful back then than they are now. I mean, that was even true in our lifetimes, if you think about it. I mean, my grandfather kept stuff forever and used it forever. Everyone did. You didn't waste money. You didn't have things at your fingertips like we have now. Not that one's better than the other, but, you know, when my grandfather couldn't just walk down to Home Depot and pick out a new hammer every time he wanted to do something. You know, he kept the old one because it worked perfectly well, and he didn't need to waste the money on buying another one just because he wanted to or couldn't find the old one or something like that, you know? And that was less than a century ago. So just imagine how much more frugal people were even centuries before that, when even coming across a hammer would be even that much more difficult than it is now, or whatever it is, a decorative button or whatever it might be. Patrick, in a second, we're going to go back to this sort of concept about outliers and what they really mean. And you'll see what I mean when we get to Lot 5. Okay, folks, that's all for the emails today. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along, diggingoakisland@gmail.com. All right, guys, it is time now to discuss Season 11, Episode 23 of The Curse of Oak Island, called Coney Island. Rather than my usual comments on the cringeworthy level of that title, I'll let Elizabeth on the Patreon handle that one. She wrote, "Does anyone know who comes up with these episode names? Some sound bad enough to make some eyes roll." Yep, in particular, this one does. I'm not sure why or when they decided to go with bad puns as episode titles, but that's what they've done, and some of them are better than others. Anyway, most of the episode actually takes place in Europe, just like it did last week, but in Denmark in particular this week. But we do have a couple of spots on the island to discuss, so let's do that first. Not much at the money pit. Marty and the crew are starting up a new core drilling project with the hole they're calling Bravo 1. This is way north in the money pit area. I mean, way north, further up than the garden shaft, really. Just above that baby blob thing you always see there. They're looking again for more precious metals and water samples. And sadly, we hear no talk about the garden shaft or any progress in fixing the issues over there. So that seems like it might well and truly be dead, but I don't want to jump to any conclusions. We could say that at least for the time being. Now, over at Lot 5, we see archaeologist Helen Sheldon and Moya McDonald working on a foundation structure there. Again, there wasn't much time spent over here, but there are a couple of things to mention quickly. First, Helen shows Marty some blue clay in the structure. Stephen B. on the live chat asked, quote, "I thought blue clay was also in the swamp. Blue clay mine and swamp was mentioned before, if I remember correctly." Stephen, you absolutely do remember correctly. In fact, a few years back, archaeologist Aaron Taylor said he believed the swamp might have been used as a source of blue clay. We don't know who might have used that source or for what purpose, but perhaps we are getting that now. Maybe whoever built this foundation used the clay in the building process. Now, predictably, we hear a lot about the blue clay reported in the Money Pit, but to me, this is less interesting than the clay in the swamp, because as far as I know, no one has ever actually seen blue clay in the Money Pit since very, very early on in the history of the dig. And a lot of that falls into the category of legend at this point. Second, during the scene, Helen Sheldon mentions that they have found a ton of creamware pottery. Well, so let me hearken back to my email earlier from in the podcast here from Patrick. If we actually have tons, as she says, of the same type of artifact, now that is something that can help us date the structure and tell us who might have built it. Much more so than some small button that is the only one of its kind in this area and nothing else is found to corroborate it. Weirdly, we get absolutely nothing on this tons of pottery other than this passing mention, although it seems to me that tons of pottery could pretty much tell us exactly when this was built. Now, we don't see any of that. We don't hear anything about it, its origins, its dating information, nothing. We know they found a lot, but they don't want to tell us anything about it. That's suspect in my mind. I'm usually not one to think the show is hiding things from us, but this one is suspicious for sure. The last spot on the island we see is actually at Lot 10, of all places. And this scene got me very, very excited because finally, at long last, the Laginas are bringing all of their money and resources to bear on examining Nolan's Cross. It's hard to believe it has taken them this long, especially considering how many theories in recent years have focused on the cross. So proving its authenticity and maybe even its age is huge to the viability of so many of these theories. So they are examining what they call Cone E. Then there's your Coney Island pun there for you. It's the boulder at the very bottom of the cross. Incredibly, they bring in a towing company of all things to lift the boulder out of its hole. What a great idea. And Marty remarks how it's like an iceberg as it comes out, as most of the mass of this boulder is actually underground, like an iceberg, most of it's underwater. And they bring this boulder up. It's just gigantic, right? So after they lift it out and they kind of secure it in place, Dr. Spooner and then soon Marty Lagina both jump into the hole to take some samples and poke around. Dr. Spooner says he doesn't see anything obviously out of place, and then Marty finds this sort of weird-looking rock that he thinks might be concrete. But again, one little rock. So later we see this rock brought to the lab for Laird Niven, Emma Culligan, and geologist Terry Matheson is there too to have a look at it. Terry seems to think it is what he calls hardened clay, and also mentions that it is kind of out of place under a huge boulder. So they turn to Emma, who tells them that the testing on the rock's makeup doesn't indicate, as she says, anything too unusual. But then Laird steps to the plate and tells the guys that when they put the rock under a microscope, they saw something very, very unusual. There's a hair embedded inside the rock. Now, that's really weird. I don't think I need to be a geologist to know that rocks generally don't have hairs embedded in them. That seems pretty obvious, don't you think? I mean, there's a lot of surprised looks, excited nods around the table, but as you might have guessed, I have a couple of questions. First, well, actually, I'll let Steve on the Patreon ask this for me. He writes, quote, "A human hair? Because they used to use horse hair in bricks and plaster." Weirdly, Steve, we don't know because they didn't say what kind of hair it was. A strange thing to leave out, don't you think? Now, hopefully next week, we get something more on this. And my other question is, this is the only interesting thing they found under the boulder? A piece of hardened clay? I mean, did they dig around more? Did they run the metal detector? I mean, it looks like Spooner took some samples for testing. Did those samples reveal anything? Now, I think we have something to look forward to here, and I'm asking for patience, and maybe my questions will be answered, because next week's episode is actually called, sorry again, A Hairy Situation. So I assume we're going to get more, at least on this hair. Weirdly, though, the episode description doesn't seem to mention anything about Nolan's cross or the hair or anything, so we'll have to just wait and see. I've been waiting a long time for someone to dig out one of these boulders. And let me just tell you, I really hope there is something more to learn about than just a piece of hair in hardened clay. Again, let's be patient. All right, it is time to head to Denmark. We begin at a really cool-looking place called Valkenburg Castle, with the team joined by Corey and Maul and historian Jaco Silvertint. The castle itself was built in 1122. It saw a lot of action, actually, throughout many conflicts, and has been kind of beat up and blown up quite a bit over the centuries. In the 20th century, when the castle was being restored, tunnels and passages were discovered under the castle, which experts say were used by the knights defending this castle during its original siege in 1122. The team here is here to take a look at these passages, which I think they refer to as a dungeon. Again, this is another location where some think the Templars might have hid during their persecution and their flight out of Europe north to Scotland and on their way to Oak Island with the Ark of the Covenant or the menorah or whatever it might be in the early 1300s. There are symbols carved into the walls, and we're shown only the ones that relate somehow to symbols found on Oak Island, including this goose paw symbol, which you see we talked about last season. Then Corey Amal points out another symbol, a square with vertical lines that he says looks like a Viking sail, which I guess it kind of does, although the show doesn't do a really good job of showing us this so we can kind of get a real good look at it and decide for ourselves. I mean, from looking at it, it could also be the bars of a jail cell from what we see here. We just don't get a good enough look, you know. I'd love to see other examples of this, which Corian says exists in other parts of Europe. So he's actually seen this more than once, and we'll get to that a little bit at the end. Next, they head to an island called Bornholm. Really bad at pronouncing Danish words because they're really full of a lot of consonants. This looks like a gorgeous place. And very cold off the east coast of Denmark. They're at a place called Nylars Church to see what the author to meet with an author and documentary filmmaker named Erling Haggensen. Nylars Church was built in the middle of the 12th century and was dedicated to St. Nicholas, who I'm hoping is Santa Claus. That's kind of cool. Now, right off the bat, alarm bells start ringing in my head because Erling tells the team that the Knights Templar came to Bornholm for what he calls an experiment to find out how long it would take to sail around the world from east to west. Be cool to learn why he thinks they came to that and what evidence he has of that, but that's not what kind of put off the alarm bells, because what did was, right after he finishes this, the narrator chimes in and says something very, very different. He says that what happened here was that, quote, members of the Viking culture help the Templars transport their sacred treasures to Oak Island. I mean, what? How exactly did we get from one to the other? And never mind the quote-unquote Viking culture thing. That's just a clever way of saying the word Vikings when they know that any of this happened, well, decades and decades after the Viking era. But how did we go from an experiment to sail the globe, from east to west, mind you, which is the wrong direction, to helping the Templars hide their treasure on Oak Island? There's a lot in between these two points, right? Maybe I'm making too much of it, but it really seemed like what I have to call purposeful deception by the narration. You know, I don't usually say that about them, but it seemed that way to me. Erling shows the team ancient rune stones, which are actually from the Viking era and were discovered along the grounds of the church in like the 17th century. To me, this is a signal that this church was built here on what was already considered sacred ground. From what I understand, this happened quite a bit, right? As Christianity spread into what I suppose would be called, I don't know if this is the right word, but pagan areas, the church sort of commandeered these old religious sacred locations. I suppose in kind of an effort to replace the old religion, both psychologically and physically, right? The stone has some symbols on it, and Doug Kroll whips out out of his pocket a picture of the 90-foot stone. I love that he has that with him at all times. And predictably, there are symbols on the rune that seem to resemble some that are found on the 90-foot stone rendering. I know I say this a lot, but this is a good place to mention it again, that no one actually knows what the 90-foot stone looks like. No one took a picture, nobody traced it, and no one has an image. What Doug is using here is one that was made decades later after it was lost by somebody's memory. So honestly, I make it a habit not to worry too much about things relating to the 90-foot stone because we don't even know if it actually existed. I mean, I think we have enough evidence that something was there, the 90-foot stone existed, but you have to remember that some of the early descriptions of it were that it could have just been accidental scratchings on this thing and not real carvings. So we often put that stuff aside and not discuss that part of the story, but that's really true. The 90-foot stone is sort of a suspect, to say the least. Next, they head to the eastern side of the island to a place called, I'm going to butcher this one, Madsabake or something, to meet with a historian named Jean Cordua. Jean Anne Cordua. She is there to show them petroglyphs carved into stones that date from the Bronze Age, which is, if you didn't know, like 3,000 years ago or even more. To me, this is a really strange scene because what we see here are ancient symbols that she calls compass symbols. And now these look like a four-dot cross that they've been making such a big deal about over the last couple of weeks. But the reason why I find this strange is, doesn't this scene show us that the four-dot cross is obviously not a uniquely Templar symbol and was used by other cultures for thousands of years? Strange that they showed us that scene. Anyway, finally, the team heads back to the Danish mainland to a coastal town called Kerteminde. I'm terrible at these things. To visit the Ladeby Viking Museum. They meet with the museum curator. Her name is Anna Jepsen Nyberg. They show her a photograph of an arrowhead or possibly a crossbow bolt that we've talked about last week. This is the one Robert Dunfield found back in the 60s, and they got off of, I think it was Mr. Dunfield's grandson, right, if I'm not mistaken. She says something like this can be found every day in this area and says it could indeed be a Viking arrowhead. If true, this is a really intriguing find. But like we said before, even if this is indeed a Viking arrowhead, in my mind, it falls into that category of an outlier that we talked about earlier in the show. We need more than one arrowhead to conclude that the Vikings were here, more than one Viking era artifact to conclude that they were there. But like I said, and also, I thought the Templars were in Nova Scotia. Did they take their arrows as well? Did they take not only their secret nautical navigational charts, but also their arrows? I don't know. The Vikings here or the Templars? Sometimes I can't get it straight. But like I said, this is a really cool find, if it's true. And this Denmark trip has been nothing short of fantastic. I love watching this stuff. But we're not done yet. Because like he promised last week, Corian Moll has a little something to add for us. But this time he sent an audio message. So I'm going to do my best to make this audio message as clean and as easy to listen to as possible. So let's give that a shot here, and I'll play this for you.
Hi, Dave, Quinn here. I'm in the car, so I can't type, so I hope you'll allow me to send you a message this way. Two things about the episode of last night. One is that, both in Castor and in Valkenburg, we found an inscription of a boat, a ship with two masts, and I think that's really special. I mean, in Castor, we're close to the river. In fact, we're on the bank of the river Meuse. In Valkenburg, you're a bit further away, and we're 150 miles from the ocean. So it makes you think, it doesn't prove that anything, went to the other side of the ocean or the Atlantic. But it does make you think, and it's pretty cool to have Templar iconography, on the wall of a medieval dungeon, medieval prison. that includes a boat. You know, this might be, you know, the one piece of evidence of a Templar flight by boat, which is very cool. And yes, it's a good question, why would Templars leave drawings on the ceiling of their hideout? No idea. I do understand why they would do it, you know, in their prison. They did that before. In Castet, you know, that's still under review, you know. And I guess the jury is still out there. So that's one. The other thing is that I think somewhere during the Denmark section, the narrator says Corian Moll believes the Templars and the Vikings cooperated to bring a treasure to Rogue Island. I can assure you that is not what Corian Moll believes or what he said anywhere. What I believe is in the Jerusalem files, and it's, you know, quite a bit different. I do love to research these topics. I think, you know, there must have been some form of contact in the Holy Land. I mean, there were Templar families with Norse roots, but it's a very broad subject and something, you know, I don't want to make, you know, quick conclusions out of. So I did not say that. It's a bit of funky editing. Have a great day, and good luck with your podcast. Take care, man. Bye.
So, guys, you could see here, just in that message, how things change as they get on to television, right? Corian Moll has his beliefs, or his what we'd call his theory, spelled out in his book, an incredible book called The Jerusalem Files. He mentioned it there. That's just recently come out. So if you really want to know what he thinks about what might have happened here, read that book. And the thing is, a lot of times these shows present these theorists or researchers or historians as believing something absolutely happened. But you can tell right there that even with all of the stuff he's finding, he would always add the word might have happened, because, as he says, he's still looking for the proof. You know, he's still looking for the thing that makes him believe that, yes, indeed, this theory that he's investigating, that he's onto, actually happened. You know, a lot of people forget that about the good theorists, about the ones that really are there to try to investigate lost history. And that's what Corian is doing with Chris Morford and their book, The Jerusalem Files. They're trying to find these things. And a question we asked last week about why on God's green earth would somebody running from the law leave evidence behind of where they were when they're on the run? Doesn't make any sense. He told you right there. It doesn't make any sense. It seems strange. He doesn't know. Because the show likes to portray that Corian thinks he knows exactly why the Templars did these things and why they left these messages or why they did this. But he's the first one to admit, it doesn't know yet. We're still on the search for those kind of things. And I think that he's right. Starting to find some sort of nautical iconography at the end of this trail is certainly a breadcrumb, you know, is certainly something that they should be following to see. Listen, I sound like I'm poke holes in things. That's my job on the podcast. Here's what I want. I want us to find out for sure that somebody came to Oak Island. If it's the Templars, boy, would that not make the greatest story. And hey, I'm a podcast about this. If we find out that Oak Island, is the home of the Templar treasure, just like some people think it might be, well, you know, I'm all in for that, guys. That helps the ratings for sure. Anyway, guys, there you go. There you have it all. And Corian gave it to us just like he always does. My thanks to him, as always. He's incredibly generous with his time and helping us fill in some of the gaps that the show leaves. Don't forget to check out his book, The Jerusalem Files, him and Chris Morford. And if you go back a couple of weeks, you'll hear a great podcast with interview with the two of them about their book. It is really, right now, the most intriguing book to read of the new stuff that's come out. And if you're a theorist, it is so wonderfully written and such a great story to tell. Check it out. So there's your plug. My way of thanking Mr. Corian Moll for participating in this podcast once again. That's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Don't forget, you can really help out the show by becoming a patron. If you think the show is worth $5 a month to you, then head over to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. Also, if you prefer, you can make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username at Dave McBride Music. Also, if you'd like to help out the show in another way, you can do so by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank you so much to everyone who's done that. But we could use some new ones. So get over there. leave your 5-star rating. You can also follow the show on Facebook. Just put at Digging Oak Island into your search bar. If you have any questions or comments you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email, diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Just keep in mind, if you do send me an email or direct message on social media, I may just answer it here on the podcast. So if you don't want that message read aloud, please make a note of that for me. Well, folks, we're getting to the end. I think there's only 2 more episodes after this last one. And I think 25 might be the end. I think that is confirmed now. So we're getting too close. So it's crown time. Let's relax and get ready for next week. Until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.